From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the February 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, a new look at Newman. The breaking of the German Lorenz cipher system was one of Bletchley Park's most complex technical achievements. This work is often associated with Tommy Flowers from the GPO. However, Flowers' work and the wider mechanisation of the breaking of Lorenz was overseen by a Cambridge mathematician who came to Bletchley Park only reluctantly in 1942, Professor Max Newman. To mark the 80th anniversary of the opening of Bletchley Park's Newmanry in February 1943, in this It Happened Here episode, we examine the story of Newman and his crucial role in the breaking of Lorenz. We're joined by Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to tell us more. Special thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, before we look at his work, shall we look at Newman the man? Can you give us a bit of biographical detail about him?
I certainly can. As you explained in your introduction, Max Newman was a Cambridge mathematician who worked here at Bletchley Park. But to start the story at the beginning, Max Newman was actually born Maxwell Neumann in February 1897 in Chelsea in London. His name was Neumann because his father was a German immigrant. Hermann Neumann had come from Bromberg, which is in East Germany, now Poland, in fact, and he'd moved to the UK when Hermann himself was a teenager. And so Max was brought up by a German father and an Irish mother. His mother, Sarah, had married Hermann in 1896. And they lived in West London in Chelsea. Hermann was a company secretary and Sarah was a schoolteacher. So reasonably comfortable middle-class family. They actually lived at 54 Lamont Road, Chelsea, which is still standing. I found it on Street View the other day. So maybe one day they can put a plaque on it. I don't know. His father was keen for him to do well. And so he entered him for scholarship exams at several schools. He actually won a scholarship to the City of London School, which is a reasonably good school. And Max was a very good student at quite a good school. He excelled in a number of things. He was good at classics, which, you know, in the period of the early part of the 20th century, that's basically what you got taught at school. So being good at classics obviously did well. He was also a keen and successful mathematician at school as well. He also played chess.
Codebreaker in the making.
This comes around with Codebreakers, isn't it? The chess seems to crop up. The thing that people forget about him was he was also a very good pianist. He played the piano at school, but also played the piano at home. And the account of his life written by his son describes how when Max was playing the piano at home in the summer, other people on Lamont Road would come out and sit on the steps of their houses to listen to him playing the piano. So, talented musician. Unfortunately, when Max is 17 years old, their family life is somewhat interrupted by the arrival in 1914 of the First World War. And of course, Hermann is a German. And so he was initially interned as an enemy alien. There were a lot of Germans in the UK prior to the First World War. Large numbers came over to the UK to work both in domestic service and in the hospitality industry, funnily enough. Like more recently, there were a lot of Europeans in the hospitality industry. So these people were all rounded up because they were considered to be deeply suspicious. So he was interned for a while. It would appear he wasn't interned for the whole war because in 1916, he went back to Germany.
Max Newman wasn't interned, though, being half German.
No, Max and Sarah stayed at home. They were technically British, but because his father carried a German passport, he was interned. In 1916, he decided to change his name, Hermann. So he adopted the anglicisation Newman for Neumann. And in due course, Sarah and Max did the same thing. They both changed their names by deed poll in 1920. So Max became Max Newman at that point. By that time, however, his father had, understandably, I suppose, gone back to Germany. So it was just the two of them. The other thing that happened during the war was when Max turned 18 in 1915, he went on to apply for and win a scholarship to Cambridge University. His maths master at school, who was a chap called F.W. Hill, encouraged him in his maths, but also encouraged him to apply to St. John's College, Cambridge, which was Hill's own former college. So presumably he could put in a good word for him with the tutors. So in 1915, Max is able to go to Cambridge. Unfortunately, the war intervenes again at this point, because although he was able to study for the first part of his mathematical tripos, as it's called. Weirdly, a tripos only has two parts. I always think a tripos ought to have three parts. But the word actually refers to the stool you sit on when you graduate, which has three legs, apparently. People write in and correct me on that now. But he'd done basically the first half of his degree until in 1917, a lot of the universities were sort of wound down and he was obliged to do something else. And so he became a school teacher. He went off to a grammar school in York, and he spent just over a year in York between January 1917 and April 1918. But then again, in April 1918, the circumstances change again because conscription is widened again. Conscription in World War I was initially introduced in 1916, but not everybody was covered by it when it was first introduced. And the pool of people that were called up got bigger and bigger as the war went on. So Max Newman finally becomes eligible for service in 1918. But at that point, he claimed a conscientious objection. It was a legal option at the time that you could say that you could become a conscientious objector. If you objected to fighting, you had to fill in lots of questionnaires and be interviewed and all sorts of things. And you could technically be sent to prison for it. But equally, the conscription authorities would find jobs that people could do, which meant they didn't have to fight. A lot of people go into the medical services and things like that. Mm-hmm. Max Newman actually goes into the pay corps, which is a fairly unwarlike pursuit.
Pay as in payment, salary?
Yes, the pay corps do the wages for soldiers.
Right.
Which, if you consider by 1918, there's something like 7 million men in the army. It's quite a big job. The precise reasons why he claimed conscientious objection, we don't know, but his parentage would have been part of it. I mean, he was half German. And so his father's family would have been on the other side, and you can quite understand why he probably wouldn't want to fight Germans. I think there's also an element of conscience about actually fighting as well involved in there, because we see again in the Second World War that he isn't the first one to sort of start singing the national anthem and marching behind the colours.
But we can't, I suppose, automatically assume he was a pacifist, for example, because he was a conscientious
objector. I think he would have had pacifist leanings. I think that's fair to say. Mm-hmm. But I think the nationality issue would have been the bigger story there. Then again, he's not the only one to change his name, because, of course, the royal family changed their name in the middle of the First World War because they're Germans as well. So he spends the rest of the war, basically, from April 1918 to the armistice in the pay corps. And then after the war, he briefly went back to school teaching in Chigwell. And it wasn't until 1919 that he was able to go back to Cambridge once the war had finished and the universities all got kind of back on a proper footing. And so in October 1919, he goes back to St. John's College and does the second half of his degree, essentially. And another 2 years, he completes his degree, and he graduated in 1921, having completed this part two of the mathematical tripos. And mathematicians at Cambridge have this slightly odd title. If you do very well in maths, you get the title of a wrangler.
Excellent.
Which sounds like you ought to be, you know, chasing buffalo on the plains, but it's a...
Gathering formulae.
Gathering formulae, yes. It's a mathematical thing. So he got a very good mathematical degree and basically just carried on with maths. He stayed at Cambridge and he wanted to become a fellow of St. John's College. And the way you do that is you do another 2 years of study. It's postgraduate research, so it's a bit like a short PhD in some ways. It's kind of you find a topic and you produce a piece of work, and then that is submitted to the fellows committee and they decide that you should become a fellow.
So he'd chosen to become a lifelong academic at this point.
Well, he had to a certain extent, but he also had a backup plan, which was he still played the piano very successfully and he had done public performances at Cambridge and elsewhere. So his son, in his biography of Max, suggests that he at least thought about the idea of becoming a professional musician, becoming a concert pianist. But you can see playing the piano and mathematics, it's a very comfortable fit. A lot of musicians are mathematicians on some level as well. But it's something that he carried on doing throughout his life, was playing the piano to quite a high standard. Well, a very high standard. While he was at Cambridge, he also started to build a sort of social circle. And a number of the people he was friends with and hung around with were luminaries in their own right. There's quite some quite famous people that he was friends with. One of those, a very close friend of his, was Lionel Penrose, who went on to be a very famous psychologist and geneticist after the Second World War. And Penrose and Newman were good friends. And in fact, in 1922, the two of them travelled to Vienna for a year to study. And you can see that from Penrose's point of view, from the psychology point of view, you know, you've got the Vienna Circle, you've got Freud and all that kind of thing. But also there's a lot of mathematics going on there as well. And so it would have been a great intellectual melting pot for them to sort of plunge into. One anecdote that does come from that time, which I think shows what kind of minds these men had, was that apparently when they were taking walks around Vienna, they would play chess with each other, remembering where the pieces were in their heads.
In their minds, my goodness.
I find this slightly boggling. I mean, I've had people say to me, oh, that's not no great achievement, but I think anyone that can play chess in their head. We talk very glibly about very clever people at Bletchley quite a lot, but when you go, oh, well, let's just walk down the street and have a game of chess.
Well, holding the board in your head and then making plans for the moves at the same time as having a conversation whilst you're out for a walk. I certainly don't know anybody that could do that.
Exactly. It didn't always work, apparently. They rarely finished a game because they get sort of halfway through and then one of them would go, you know, would make a move and go, haven't you got a pawn there? I go, I don't think so. And then they would just fall to arguing about where the pieces were.
So they're human after all.
So they are human after all. Excellent. But just to attempt it in the first place, I think, is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But anyway, Newman came back from Vienna in 1923. And that's when his fellowship is confirmed and he became a fellow of St. John's College. And at that point, his academic career is made. Basically, he can stay as a fellow at St. John's, working away on whatever he chooses to work on. And he chooses as his sort of main theme, topology.
I have no idea what that is.
Topology, it's sort of geometry, but it's looking at shapes, both two-dimensional and three-dimensional, it verges into graph theory. Mm-hmm, it's about, you know, connections and nodes and vertices. Mathematicians out there will be laughing at the pair of us and shouting because we've never claimed to be mathematicians.
We're not the people to
explain
this.
We talk about math. We don't necessarily know much math. But yes, he was a topologist. And this is important because at that period in the UK, certainly there were very few topologists. So he kind of had the field to himself. Mm. And he very rapidly became one of the leading figures in it and published quite prolifically. He published in excess of 20 academic papers on topology prior to the Second World War. However, Newman's not just doing research. If you are at Oxford and Cambridge, we talk glibly about dons. You are only a don if you hold a college position, so you're a fellow of a college, but also you hold a position in an academic department. So in 1927, he was appointed a lecturer in the mathematics department at Cambridge. So once he was a lecturer and a fellow of a college, he becomes a Cambridge don. And so he starts teaching mathematics to students as well as doing research in 1927. During this period, he's also becomes friends with another figure who we have, I think, mentioned before in the podcast, which is Patrick Blackett. Patrick Blackett, he's only very peripherally connected with Bletchley Park, but he was a very significant figure. During the war, he was head of operational research at the Admiralty. Operational research is studying, in a statistical way, how effective operations are. Because a lot of tactics and operational procedures had been developed on the basis of basically hearsay and experience. Pilots would go out and claim to have shot down Germans and people would write the results down and plan what to do on the basis of that. Operational research is about being much more scientific and pulling in huge amounts of different data to try and work out the optimal way of doing things. One of the things that Blackett's team worked on, for example, is what is the best size for an Atlantic convoy? Should you have 10 ships or should you have 100 ships? And they did various, studied the data and did calculations and worked out that actually, I think it's about 60 ships is the best balance between, you know, unwieldiness and carrying stuff. So that's what operational research is. But prior to that, Blackett was in the physics department at Cambridge and supervised a number of people who went on to be famous physicists, Robert Oppenheimer amongst them, of atomic bomb fame. He was a student of Blackett. And Blackett and Newman became very good friends. I mean, they were friends to the extent that Blackett was actually best man at Newman's wedding. We'll come back to Patrick Blackett later because he will crop up again in our story. But the other thing that happens in the late 1920s, which is important in Newman's story, is he went for the first time to Princeton University in the United States. And he was appointed there a Rockefeller Research Fellow, as the name implies, posts funded by the Rockefellers.
How do you get to be appointed in a university in the States, if you're based, I mean, was it just his renown?
Well, what it is they have temporary fellowships where the idea was that there was funding for students from European universities to go to Princeton for a year to mix with the academics at Princeton and study with them and exchange ideas and then go back to their own universities again. And I mean, Cambridge has similar fellowships for students from other universities as well. So it's quite a common thing in the academic community for people to spend time temporarily at other institutions. Mm-hmm. And basically you apply, you get lots of your friends to write letters on your behalf, you fill in a form and hopefully they give you some money. So Newman went off to Princeton between 1928 and 1929 for a year. While he was there, he met Henry Whitehead, who is another famous mathematician. And they met together at Princeton. When they came back to the UK, Whitehead was actually based at Oxford. So Newman went back to Cambridge, Whitehead went back to Oxford, but they stayed friends. Whitehead was another part of Newman's sort of expanding network. As we usual here, he went back to Princeton several times subsequently. So he's a very strong connection. And you have to think, this is 1928, 1929, but certainly in the 1930s, Princeton is a real focus for mathematicians, physicists, and other experts in that sort of area. Einstein is at Princeton, for example, during the 1930s, as is John von Neumann, no relation, and a whole raft of other very important figures who go on to be significant in computing and in the Manhattan Project and other important stories. So, but we'll get to all that as we go forward. But remember Princeton because it plays an important part in all of this. As I described earlier, Newman got married in 1934, once he'd come back from America, with Patrick Blackett as best man. He married Lynn Lloyd Irvin, who was a writer. They subsequently had two children. They had two sons, Edward born in 1935 and William born in 1939. So by the time you get to the outbreak of the Second World War, he's married, he's got two young children. He settled in Cambridge as a mathematician. The other famous person he's counting among his circle of friends is Bertrand Russell, the philosopher. Mm-hmm. So you see the sort of circles he's moving in. There's all the great brains of the time.
One last question. Suppose, Lord Russell, this film were to be looked at by our descendants, like a Dead Sea Scroll in 1,000 years' time. What would you think it's worth telling that generation about the life you've lived and the lessons you've learned from it?
I should like to say two things. One intellectual and one moral. The intellectual thing I should want to say to them is this. When you are studying any matter or considering any philosophy, ask yourself only, what are the facts and what is the truth that the facts bear out? Never let yourself be diverted either by what you would wish to believe or by what you think would have beneficent social effects if it were believed. But look only and solely at what are the facts. That is the intellectual thing that I should wish to say. The moral thing I should wish to say to them is very simple. I should say, love is wise, hatred is foolish. In this world, which is getting more and more closely interconnected, we have to learn to tolerate each other. We have to learn to put up with the fact that some people say things that we don't like. We can only live together in that way. And if we are to live together and not die together, we must learn a kind of charity and a kind of tolerance, which is absolutely vital to the continuation of human life on this planet.
Speaking of great brains of the time, a name that listeners will be familiar with is Alan Turing. He was at Cambridge at the same time as Newman, is that correct?
He was, and he wasn't just at Cambridge at the same time. He was actually a student of Newman's. Newman was his supervisor. As I said, in 1927, Newman had started lecturing in the Department of Mathematics. In 1934, he starts a lecture series entitled Foundations of Mathematics, which was, it's more of a logic course in many ways, and this is a connection with Russell and everybody else, that Russell famously writing his book on foundational logic and mathematics. Turing attended the course and then was looking for a research topic. And it was in discussion with Newman that Turing decided to embark on his work on, famously, on the Entscheidungsproblem.
Which is very briefly.
those mathematicians are listening again.
For a layperson.
It's about whether all of maths is decidable or not. And by decidable, it means, can you write a theorem, can you write an algorithm that will describe all of maths? And this is a philosophical question that has been argued back and forth. Turing started researching this, and his famous paper in the spring of 1936 on computable numbers with an application to the Entscheidungsproblem is all about it. And he came up with a solution saying that mathematics was ultimately not decidable. This is very significant mathematics, but also it is a very significant paper because the on-computable numbers part, kind of incidentally on his way to talking about decidability, Turing hypothesizes his Turing machine in that paper, which has all of its ramifications for modern computing and AI and everything else. So Newman is intimately involved in that research that Turing is doing and in the production of that paper. And it would seem that they became quite good friends at the time as well. They had shared mathematical interests, but they seemed to get on. You know, they were family friends as well as colleagues. Newman is keen to see Turing succeed and his career flourish. And one of the things he does is arrange for Turing to go to Princeton. Newman had already been to Princeton 7 years before, and he was in touch with various mathematicians there. And in particular, he's in touch with Alonzo Church, who was working on the same decidability problems that Turing was looking at. And so Newman is able to arrange for Turing to go to Princeton for a time. The problem arises that Church has actually written a paper that attacks the exact same problem that Turing's on computable numbers attacks. Church gets his paper published first. And in a lot of academic circles, if somebody else beats you to the punch, if they produce their research first, your paper becomes a bit redundant and it never gets published. So we may never have heard of uncomputable numbers. But Newman thought it was a sufficiently good piece of work that it should be published anyway. And he argued successfully with the mathematical journals that Turing's approach to the problem, although he reached a similar conclusion, was sufficiently different from Church's approach that the two papers were worth publishing. And Turing's paper is indeed published in 1937. And that's mostly Newman's doing. And it's during this period when Turing is hypothesizing the Turing machine and the computing part of the uncomputable numbers that him and Newman are clearly having conversations about mechanical computing, even if it's only not in an engineering sense, but in a mathematical theoretical sense. You know, is it possible to theorize a machine that would be a computer? The birth of that idea is really, really important when people look at the history of computing as a whole. This is one of the very early times when people are talking about building machines to do computing.
I think in our exhibition that we have here at Bletchley Park about Turing, there's a collection of Turing's published papers. Am I right that they did belong to Newman previously?
Yes, the collection we have on display is Max Newman's collection of offprints of Turing's publications.
Including uncomputable numbers.
Including uncomputable numbers. Because when you publish an academic paper, it appears in the printed journal. But also you get what they call offprints, where the publisher of the journal will send you a pile of unbound copies of just your article. You keep them in your desk drawer, you give them to your friends and you circulate them. The thing about uncomputable numbers was that relatively few offprints were produced and Turing didn't give many of them away. So if you've got one in your loft now, you're probably going to be quite wealthy because they change hands for a great deal of money.
Wow.
Because they're such a foundational paper. What's nice about the offprints we have here is they were Newman's working copies and they actually have Newman's annotations on them as well. So you get double your money because you've got Turing's paper, but also with Newman's annotations. So if you're an enthusiast for 1930s mathematics, they're a wonderful collection to come and look at downstairs in Block B.
Definitely.
So Newman arranges for Turing to go off to Princeton, and Newman himself was able to follow him in September 1937. This time he's able to take Lynn and the children, and so they go as a family off to Princeton. Not to Princeton University, but to the Institute for Advanced Study, which is a separate institution for very, very clever people indeed, which is based at Princeton University, but not technically part of it. That's where Einstein works.
You mentioned that Turing was a friend of Newman as well. So did they spend a lot of time together socially as well as professionally?
It seems they did. And again, I refer back to William Newman's biography. And he talks about when he was a child in the 1950s, meeting Turing and Turing coming to stay with them as a family and going on holiday with them and things like that. He clearly liked Turing very much and saw him as, sort of some families, you have people who you call your uncles, even though they're not your uncles kind of thing.
Yeah.
You get the feeling that the relationship was a bit like that, that Turing was a regular visitor.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, went on holiday with them. And there's a rather lovely quote actually about William's impression of Turing. Alan became a close family friend. Despite his shyness, he seemed to be more approachable than the other mathematicians who visited us. His choice of presents at our birthdays was especially thoughtful and generous. A splendid steam engine one year, a little hobbyist's toolkit another. He played games with me and Edward and often lost. His worst defeat was when he asked, did we have a Monopoly set and would we have a game with him? If he had a strategy for winning at this game, it must have been scuppered by our homebrewed design with its extra diagonal row of properties. He finished in a state of spectacular bankruptcy. On another occasion, he challenged me to a game of blindfold chess, a new experience for me. He sat on the sofa with his head turned away from me and the board, and we called out our moves to each other. Things seemed to be going well for me when he excused himself and left the room. Returning, he called out his move, checkmate. It would have been like him to hesitate before administering this coup de grace on a friend's young son. Alan came with us on a brief spring holiday in Cricieth, North Wales, where we had rented a house. There were lively discussions in our seafront living room between him, my father, Bertrand Russell, Rupert Crawshay Williams, and others. Just Bertrand Russell, you know.
There's the beach out there, but why would you when you can sit indoors debating?
William Newman himself spoke about some of this. Back in 2012, Bletchley Park had a themed Monopoly set available, and William came to talk to us about Monopoly.
What would you like to be, the car or the hat?
I'll be the hat. The board that we're talking about is one that I drew on a piece of paper probably when I was about, I don't know, maybe about 12. Monopoly board sets were rather expensive. So rather than try and persuade my parents to fork out, I thought, well, why don't I just draw a Monopoly board?
And as for the game where you managed to beat Alan Turing, what do you remember of that moment?
No, a slight embarrassment. I just remember that we played it. It was just a Monopoly game like any other one. You know, many years afterwards, I assumed that he had some sort of strategy for how to win. But I think on reflection, he probably didn't want to win. He made sure that he didn't.
The original board was lost for a number of years.
Yes, well, it sort of lay around in the family house in Cambridge until my father died in 84. And then the house was sold to a couple who have really sort of taken it to their hearts. They looked after it and preserved it and kept things they found, which included the Monopoly board. And so when I went out there, I took my son with me because he hadn't been there. So we went out there so that I could just show him the house. It's on a crossroads. And the owners saw me and said, oh, would you like to come in? So we had a proper tour. And when we left, he handed me this folder, opened it, and there it was.
And how did you feel getting that game back after so many years?
I was really pleased.
And now the board has been donated to Bletchley Park.
Yes. I think I was pleased because it survived, not because I'd been denied the opportunity to play Monopoly for all these years. And now it's at Bletchley Park. It seemed to me highly appropriate that they should look after him.
The board we've got in front of us is the developed board. It doesn't have the diagonal line across it anymore.
No.
But it is now a Monopoly board. It's been changed and turned into one, and it will be released. How do you feel about that, seeing what you created so many years ago at the age of 12 being developed into a board game that will be sold and played by many, many people?
Well, I think it's a brilliant idea. I think anything that publicizes his name and his career, anything that gets people to know more about him, I think is just a splendid thing to do.
So taking us back to Princeton, you mentioned that Newman took his family out in 1937?
Yes, so he would have been in Princeton with his family, but also with Turing, who was there at the time, and all of the other luminaries of the Institute of Advanced Study and Princeton University. We mentioned Einstein earlier, of course. The Einstein fans among our listeners will know that Einstein was quite an accomplished violinist. And apparently Newman accompanied Einstein on the piano while Einstein played his violin.
I would give money to have seen that. How amazing would that have been?
Quite a sight. Well, quite a sound.
Quite a
sound,
yeah. Did he stay in Princeton for long?
Only for about a year. So they're back in the UK by 1939, when the Second World War begins.
So war broke out in September 1939. Was Newman called to serve at Bletchley Park like Turing was?
It was certainly thought about. One of the things we found in the National Archives is the so-called emergency list, which is where Alistair Denniston was given budget to recruit the famous men of a professor type. And there are all sorts of names on that list. Alan Turing, Gordon Welshman. Newman's name is on the list, but cryptically rather, it has the word no written in capital letters and circled next to his name. And we know that he didn't come to Bletchley Park in 1939. So his name was obviously up for consideration. But whether it was him that said no or whether it was the organisation that said no, we're not really sure. And of course, later on, when he does become interested in Bletchley Park, his German ancestry was a factor. And in 1939 or 1938, when these lists were drawn up and they were still working by the peacetime rules effectively, that would have disqualified him. So he didn't come to Bletchley immediately at the beginning of the war, but he was certainly considered for it.
If he was approached, do we think he would have wanted to come to Bletchley Park at the start of the war?
I'm not sure that he would, given his reticence later in 1942. And also, he seems to have made war plans that didn't include Bletchley. His academic career was going very well. In 1939, for example, he was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society, and he was a distinguished and successful mathematician by that point. He was also concerned about his wife's Jewish heritage and his own German heritage, that if the UK were invaded, which seemed like a possibility, it's not out of the question in 1940, that they didn't want to be anywhere near the Nazis. So he came up with a plan that he and the whole family should move to America. And the obvious place to go was Princeton. And it would kill many birds with the same stone, because he could obviously research with all the people he knew at Princeton and continue his mathematical career. But it would also place his family somewhere where they would be safe from whatever turn World War II took. And of course, in 1939-40, people were very uncertain what was going to happen. So he wrote to Princeton and made his case to come back again. But this came up against one of the members of the maths department over there, another quite famous mathematician called Oswald Veblen, who, despite his name, was an American. He was professor at the Institute of Advanced Study, but was also a World War I veteran. And he had a much more gung-ho attitude to war, I suppose you could call it. And he wrote back saying that the middle of a war was no time to be running off to America and that Newman should be doing his bit for the war. He actually said, "Every able-bodied man ought to be carrying a gun or hand grenade and fight for his country." I'm not sure Newman would have been best used with a gun or a hand grenade. So Veblen blocks Newman's application to Princeton. However, Lynn and the two boys went to America for safety, and Newman stayed at Cambridge on his own and carried on with his research work.
But he did end up at Bletchley Park, as we know. So tell us a bit about that.
He did end up at Bletchley Park, and he must have been aware that, well, I mean, Turing went to Bletchley Park. Turing would not have spoken to him directly about what he was doing, but Turing clearly disappears from Cambridge and goes off down to Bletchley, and any number of other Cambridge figures.
From St John's as well, from his own college.
From his own college. So he would have been aware that these people had all gone off to do this, and he may even have been approached in 1939. The problem we have is that the correspondence in 1942 doesn't give any hint that Newman knew anything about Bletchley Park, but they wouldn't necessarily write that down anyway. It becomes clear that by the spring of 1942, the pressure was building, if you like. Newman was starting to think that sitting in Cambridge doing maths wasn't necessarily the best use of his time in the middle of a war. And so he puts feelers out among his professional acquaintances to see whether there's something more warlike he could do. And this is where Patrick Blackett comes back into the story. His best man, Patrick Blackett, is now at the Admiralty. He is now at the centre of the intelligence war in many ways. He's part of Division of Naval Intelligence. And he knows Admiral Godfrey, who we've spoken about before, who is Director of Naval Intelligence. Presumably at Newman's behest, Patrick Blackett wrote a letter to Admiral Godfrey at Naval Intelligence, putting forward Newman as a possible useful candidate for employment.
Personal. 13th of May, 1942. Dear Godfrey, the man I mentioned to you is M.H.A. Newman of St. John's College, Cambridge. He is about 45 and was born in England, his father being German and his mother English. He is one of the most intelligent people I know, being a first-class pure mathematician, an able philosopher, a good chess player and musician. He has also had a considerable amount of university and college administrative experience. Do you think you could use him in any way? Yours sincerely, Blackett.
It's interesting that Blackett mentions Newman's musicality in that letter, actually. He's probably still playing the piano. Clearly this worked, because there are a flurry of letters, and if you go to the St. John's College archive, which is very conveniently available online, almost all of the series of letters that led to Newman's recruitment to Bletchley Park are preserved in that archive. And you can follow the back and forth between the various key players as they decide, and Newman decides what he should do if he comes to Bletchley. One of the first people to get involved is Frank Adcock, who was a professor of ancient history at Cambridge, but had been a member of Room 40 during the First World War. So he was right in the heart of the codebreaker establishment. Mm,
and a pretty established recruiter for GCSE by now.
Adcock, he kind of lurks around Cambridge. He's a talent spotter at Cambridge.
A tapper of shoulders.
That's a good way to put it. And in St. John's College archive is the letter from Adcock to Newman alluding to what they do at Bletchley Park.
Dear Newman, There is some work going at a government institution which would, I think, interest you, and which is certainly important for the war. If you are disposed towards it, would you let me know, and a meeting will be arranged to talk it over with someone, without either party being committed to anything in advance. In that case, as time is getting on, could you please also consider the other obvious point, whether the university and college would be prepared to release you? Charlesworth, though he, like me, is not at liberty to say much, can add his assurance to mine that the work is of importance, if you care to have a word with him. Yours sincerely, F. E. Adcock.
The letter from Adcock says nothing explicit about what's happening at Bletchley Park, but I think we can be pretty sure that Newman would have had an inkling. And even though he's not been at Bletchley Park, he knows enough of the players and he's been around enough of these people for long enough that he must have had some sort of shrewd idea. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting how many significant figures at Bletchley become involved, because on the 1st of June 42, Newman also gets a letter from Nigel de Grey, again, World War I codebreaker, which has the sender's address as Room 47 at the Foreign Office, which is, as we know, one of the cover addresses for Bletchley Park. He wrote that one of our principals, as he put it, so somebody from Bletchley was going to be in Cambridge to have a chat. Oh, he calls it an interview. It probably wasn't as formal as an interview, but certainly to have a chat with Newman. One of the issues that crops up in these letters is Newman's father's nationality, because according to the recruitment criteria pre-war, both your parents had to be British to work for GCNCS. By 1942, they've softened that rule quite substantially. There's a number of German emigres and descendants of emigres who are employed at Bletchley Park. Rolf Nosquith is an example. So while in 1939, that might have been a complete bar, it might have been the source of the no in the circle in the list, by 1942, it's much more of an arguable point. Nationality turned out not to be an issue, because in July 1942, he got a letter from Alan Bradshaw, who was Assistant Director of Administration at Bletchley Park, or would be subsequently, offering him a job as a temporary senior assistant, which was a grade that the sort of senior code-breaking grade that people like Turing and Welshman were employed at £600 a year, which was a decent whack in those days. And it specifically states in that letter that his father's nationality was not an issue and everything would be fine. One of the concerns around this point, though, is while Bletchley might want Newman, Newman hasn't yet decided whether he wants Bletchley. And he had reservations that while he wanted to do something for the war effort, he didn't want to be bored. He wanted something that he felt matched his intellectual capabilities. And so he was keen that he should be given something of sufficient significance, if you like. And again, in July, there's a letter again from Patrick Blackett, who writes to Newman saying that he shouldn't worry about this and that Blackett reckoned that the work would be enough to keep you interested.
That interested thing is interesting, actually. It feels like there's a bit of a campaign going here. Adcock's mentioned interested, Travis, Blackett. They want to sort of make sure that he's keen.
Yeah, I mean, you have to wonder who's asking who here at this point.
Who's recruiting who?
You know, that although it ostensibly starts with a letter from Blackett to Godfrey, and you have to believe that Newman instigated that there's quite a lot of back and forth. It's not only about whether the work will be interesting enough, but you also get a little bit of a tug of war within Bletchley Park itself, because F.L. Lucas, who was in Hut 3 at the time, suggested that Newman come and work for him in Hut 3. But John Tiltman, who has at that point, the previous year, he set up the new research section with Bill Tutt and Norman Sainsbury and all these other people. Tiltman also has work that he thinks Newman can do. So the two of them are kind of bidding for Newman's services.
Enticing him away from academia.
In their relevant section.
Yeah.
Newman does finally accept the post in August 1942, and he wrote a letter confirming that back to Bradshaw at Bletchley Park.
15th of August 1942. The Assistant Director, Administration, Bletchley Park, Bucks. Dear Sir, I wish now to accept your offer of a position as Senior Assistant at a commencing salary of £600. I understand from Colonel Tiltman that the appointment will be for 1 year, at the end of which I shall be free to give up if I wish. I shall be free to take up the appointment at the end of this month. The university and college authorities have already given their consent. Will you be kind enough to put me in touch with the billeting officer? I could, if necessary, pay a visit to Bletchley to look for lodgings. Yours faithfully, Newman.
But despite writing that letter, it appears that Newman still hasn't quite made up his mind who he's going to work for. And it's only later that he writes to Tiltman and says, since his visit, that he's chosen to work for Tiltman and not for Lucas. And again, there's a letter in the archive of Tiltman writing back going, I'm pleased you have chosen to come on our side. So, and I think history is pleased that he chose to go on that side as well, because what Newman would have done in Hut 3, I don't know, but I doubt it would have been quite as significant as what he ended up doing.
And stayed for longer than a year as well.
Yes, this is the other feature of the letter Newman writes to Bradshaw is you can see Newman still has reservations about the job. And there's a lot of people who get a job at Bletchley who are told, you don't know what the job is, take it or leave it. And if you take it, you can never leave. And that's that. It's a done deal. Newman gets it not quite written into his contract, but agreed in writing that if he decides he doesn't like the work, he can just go back to Cambridge.
They must have known he'd want to stay.
Well, surely. I think they were gambling on a fairly safe bet that he'd want to stay. Mm-hmm. But in order to get him to come, they have to give him the option. He's clearly being enticed in various ways, actually, because there's some other more sort of administrative letters in the same archive. There's a nice letter from the billeting officer, Herbert Griffith, in August 42, describing where they found a place for Newman to live. This is described as a very nice billet in a modern house with constant hot water. And this is run by Mrs. Dutton. Gladview, Cottingham Grove, Bletchley. If you go down Wilton Avenue and cross the road at the end, drop down to where the Eight Bells is, mm-hmm. more or less opposite is Cottingham Grove.
Walking distance, so very short walking distance.
It's less than 5 minutes walk away. So compared to the people that are being put up in Bedford or...
And having heard about the quality of some of the accommodation, a modern house with constant hot water sounds absolutely marvellous.
One of the mysteries this presents, though, is that Herbert Griffith's letter says that Newman will be sharing with Professor Green, which is presumably not the casino company, or the rap star. Mm. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to identify which Professor Green this might be. Tom and I have been looking up the various Greens and Professors Green who were on our roll of honour, and we haven't been able to pin this to anybody. So if anyone knows who Professor Green is...
That might have been this particular Professor Green, definitely get in touch.
Just to be clear, not the rap star. Don't go Googling Professor Green, you'll waste a lot of time. So by the end of August, Newman has taken up the post. And one of the last letters in that series in the archive is a rather belated letter from the Foreign Office saying that he has been appointed to this post. But the letter is actually dated after he'd arrived. So it's a typical case of the admin catching up with the job. And Newman at that point is appointed to Tiltman's research section. And one of the more significant tasks that the research section is working on in the late summer of 1942 is, of course, Lorenz Tunney. And they've already set up Ralph Tester's section, the Testery, who have already had success breaking Lorenz messages using very tedious hand techniques. And Newman is posted to the Testery in October.
Regular listeners to the podcast might be very knowledgeable about the Lorenz cipher, but for those that perhaps don't have that background information, you've used the terms Lorenz and Tunney. Do those mean the same thing?
Broadly speaking, yes. What we're talking about here is a cipher system. Everyone's heard of Enigma, which is the German cipher machine that was used for most of their military communications at sort of between divisional level and army level, so quite high level communication. For their very high level communications between sort of field marshals and Hitler and all the very senior people, it had another wireless system which relied on teleprinter code instead of Morse code, so bow dot teleprinter code. And what this did was the Lorenz cipher machine, you got your ordinary teleprinter and plugged one end of the Lorenz machine into your teleprinter and the other end into your wireless set, and you could basically type on your teleprinter and the machine would automatically encipher that signal, and then it would go into the wireless and be transmitted, and the person who listened to it at the other end could feed it automatically through another Lorenz machine and it would come out as plain text. So it's a very efficient system. Mm-hmm. And it allows you to write much longer messages. Enigma messages are typically 250 characters. Lorenz messages are 4,000 or 5,000 characters long.
All right. So you can go to prose and
yes. I refer to them very loosely as emails rather than tweets. Mm-hmm. That if you think about them in that sort of difference.
Right.
From 1940, signals start to be intercepted which are coming from the Lorenz communications links. Well, one link in particular between Vienna and Athens. But other links proliferate. And John Tiltman's research section sets about trying to work out how these messages have been enciphered and then works out a method for breaking the messages, breaking the encipherment. We've done several podcasts about Lorenz in the past, so keen listeners can dial back and look at those to hear more of the detail of that story. But where Newman comes on board is that the Testery, had developed a methodology for getting into Tunny traffic. And there are basically two problems with Tunny. Unlike Enigma, the rotors in the machine are settable in the sense they have little pins that either poke out or don't on the wheels. And so there's a process called wheel braking, which is working out how the wheels in the machine have been configured. And then there's a separate activity, which is called wheel setting, which is where at the beginning of each message, the operator would set the wheels to a particular starting point, a bit like Enigma rotors.
Yeah.
So you have wheel braking and wheel setting. Wheel setting had been helped up until the end of 1942 by the fact that the Germans were sending the wheel settings as part of the preamble to the message. I mean, it was encrypted, but it gave you a clue. Mm-hmm. However, from around the time Newman turns up, the Germans stopped doing that. So wheel setting, finding the starting position of the wheels for each message, becomes vastly more difficult. And this is the problem that the research section is looking at. So they are already breaking messages and they're making progress with Tunny, but the situation isn't ideal by any means. The amount of traffic they've got versus the number of things they're actually reading means that they need to come up with a new approach. And it's while Newman is in the testuary that he has a conversation with Jerry Morgan, who was the head of the research section, and Bill Tutt, who had been working on Lorentz way back since summer of 41. The point about this is Tutt has come up with a method of wheel setting that he thinks will work. And for this, we need to look at a little bit more about how Tunny works, how Lorentz encrypted the message. And what it does is the Baudot-Murray code, which is how teleprinter messages are expressed. If you imagine a paper tape with holes punched in it, there are five positions which can either be a hole or not a hole.
Across the width of the tape.
Across the width of the tape. Across or a dot, as Bletchley Park calls them. And the cipher works by adding a second cipher letter to the plain text letter using effectively binary addition. So you get another letter. If you add one letter to another letter in their five-dot form, you get a third letter.
Right.
And it encrypts it. And actually, the Lorentz machine does that twice. So you get two layers of encryption. This isn't necessarily a very new idea. This is called a Vernam cipher of teleprinter code. And Vernam ciphers have been around for a long time prior to the Second World War. But the problem was always, how do you create the key, as it's called, the string of random letters that you apply to the letters in the message? Mm-hmm. And how you generate that string of characters is a problem, because the person at the receiving end has to know them as well as the person at the sending end. And you could theoretically produce a very, very long tape and give a copy of it to each person, and you'd effectively have a one-time pad system. But exchanging tapes is very difficult. So the point about the Lorentz machine is it generates, by the circling of the rotors in the machine, the wheels in the machine, it generates that character string in a pseudo-random but predictable way. So that if the guy at the other end has set his machine to the same starting setting, he will get the same code string generated and added to his message. Or in his case, subtracted from his message to get you the plain text. One of the ideas that someone had back in the 30s for generating key for Vernam ciphers was to use two teleprinter tapes. A guy called Lyman Morehouse came up with this concept that if you had a tape 1,000 characters long and you added that over and over again to your message, obviously the cipher would repeat every 1,000 characters, which isn't very secure. But he said, if you have one tape going around 1,000 characters and you have a second tape doing the same thing, adding a second letter, but is only 999 letters long,
it will shift it.
It will shift by one place every time.
Right.
And you end up with a key which is 999,000 letters long, thus vastly more secure. That never caught on, and no one's heard of Lyman Morehouse, except extreme cryptographers, because that machine was never produced. But what's important about it is it introduces this concept. If you have two tapes, you can generate a very long key, or you can manipulate how a key is applied to a ciphertext. And the conversation between Tutt and Newman and Morgan is about a solution to the Lorentz machine that Tutt has developed. He comes up with the idea that if you know the wheel settings of the Lorentz machine, you can generate a tape with a portion of the key on it. But then the question is, where does that key fit in relation to the letters of the message?
If you had one tape sat on top of the other tape, where would it sit?
Sliding along.
Okay, yeah.
And what they figure out between them is if you have a tape with the message on it and you have a tape with the key on it, you can work out the starting point of the key if you make sure that one tape is one letter longer than the other and you run them past one another very quickly, they will try all the possibilities.
Lots and lots of times.
Lots and lots of times. 2,000 times a second or something like that. So very, very fast. Not fast enough, as it turned out, but pretty fast. And this also exploits a feature of the teleprinter code, the Baudot code, which is that Emil Baudot, when he invented it, was worried that the punched paper tape would tear. And so he made very common letters of the alphabet have relatively few holes and used sort of 5 holes and 4 holes in the tape for rare letters, you know, Z and Q and things, which made the tape stronger. But what that means is if you do the process we've described, where you compare the key to the message, if the key is in the wrong position relative to the message, you'll get gobbledygook. Mm-hmm. And the frequencies with which each alphabetical letter occurs will be flat, random. If your key drops onto the message in the right position, your message will be partially deciphered. And so the letter frequency won't be flat random. It will be a version of, a very weak version of, the letter frequencies that occur in actual German. And I hope everyone's still with me. The final stage of this is, if you know that the letters that are frequent in natural German are also the letters that don't have as many holes, you can count the holes. And if you get slightly fewer holes than you would if it was completely random, you know you've probably hit the right setting. It's marginal and you have to do a lot of counting a lot of times, but there is a statistical difference that emerges in this process. But it only emerges if you count thousands and thousands of letters. But what that meant was, although Tutte had come up with a theoretical principle, he hadn't actually come up with a workable code-breaking methodology, because if you got somebody with a 2 pieces of tape and some squared paper,
the task is
it
immense,
would take them years to do it. Because it's beyond, you know, human power to achieve it. But between the three of them, they reckon this is doable by a machine. You could get a machine to count the holes quickly enough.
I can't help but feel mechanizing it is the absolute
mechanizing
solution.
Mechanizing is the answer. There is a connection way back. This is more of a philosophical point than a real connection, but it takes us back to oncomputable numbers and the idea of a machine with a tape that is processing the tape. There's clearly a mechanical, mathematical process being done by this machine, which is in the cloud of thoughts that Newman and Turing have been having since 1936. And so what they do is they decide that Newman should take on the job of developing this device. And this is why we're doing the podcast now, because in February 1943, Edward Travis, who was head of GC&CS by then, he appoints Newman to head a machine coordination and development section, which is basically a unit to build a thing that will do Tutte's process. And he puts them in Hut 11, which was originally a bomb hut, but the bombs have now been moved to Hut 11A and off-site.
Just very quickly interject here, because you've mentioned Hut 11, you've mentioned a machine. We aren't talking about bomb machines here at all. The technology is very, very different.
Yes. Well, there is a link to bomb machines that we will come to, but it's a different cipher system. It's a completely different machine. It's not the bombs. That's a separate project being worked on by other people. So we shouldn't get those two confused. And like the Testery, which is named after Ralph Tester, this section is rapidly christened the Newmanry.
He's made it. He has a department.
He has a department. Some people have a process. Turingery is a process. The Newmanry is an institution. Initially, it's an institution of 3 people, because in February 1943, Newman only has 2 people working for him. They were both very good people because they become big names in their own right after the war, which we'll come to. These are Donald Mickey, who was a classicist who had been working in the testery, doing the manual methods, and another chap called Jack Good, who was a mathematician who had been working with Alan Turing on Enigma statistics previously. So these two chaps are given to Newman to develop this machine. And again, we reference the bombs because there is a perception with the bomb machines put about by the imitation game that Turing literally built the bomb.
Screwdrivers and all.
Screwdrivers and spanners and all of that, and on his own in a hut. He didn't. Mm-hmm. How you do these things is you contract them out to engineering companies. You come up with an idea, and then you go to a load of engineers in a factory and say, make me one of these.
Better placed and more knowledgeable to do it.
Exactly. So Newman needs to find some people to do this work. And this is where the bombs come in, because Bletchley Park has already been working with a number of different engineering outfits to do this. I mean, the famous one is British Tabulating Machines in Letchworth, who are building bombs at this point. But previously in 1942, there has been the crisis around four rotor naval Enigma. And so a new bomb machine was needed in 1942, and more companies beyond BTM have got involved. One of those is the General Post Office Research Station at Dollis Hill in North London. They had done work on bomb machines. And the other is the Telecommunications Research Establishment at Malvern, so-called because it has nothing to do with telecommunications. TRE was actually working on radars. But from Newman's point of view about these two organisations is TRE, he thinks, are good at electronics, and they had built electronic counters as part of their four-rotor bomb programme in 1942. So he thinks, yeah, if we need an electronic counter, a counter of holes, they will be good people to do it. At the same time, the GPO and Dollis Hill are all over teleprinters. And so if you want something with tapes going around and the sort of mechanical functions, they're your people. And also, if you've got two teams working on the problem, it takes half the time because you can share the load. So Newman commissions both groups. There's an engineer called Frank Morrill, who works at GPO, who takes on the tape work. And there's an engineer called Godfrey Wynne Williams, after whom the Wynne Williams bomb machine from 1942 is named, who was at TRE Malvern. So they both start working on this project. And we know all this because there's a very important document on the history of Lorenz called the General Report on Tunney, which is another of these hut histories that was compiled after the end of the war. Mickey and Good actually wrote some of it along with other people. And it's a very technical, very long description of how the various Tunney braking machines worked and the history of the development of it all.
This document's available in the National Archives, isn't it?
It is. It's in the National Archives. It was only declassified in 2004, I think, so it's quite a recent release.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating document. You wouldn't want to sit down and read
it. It's a heavy and weighty and...
It's highly technical.
Technical tone, exactly, yes.
But the General Report on Tunney is quite specific about this, and I can read the relevant section from page 33. It says, the idea of using electronic counters to carry out these procedures, which I mean Tutt's process, at a practically useful speed was put forward by MHA Newman, and in December 1942, he was given the task of developing machine methods for setting Tunney. So there we go. That is Newman being appointed to solve this problem, to create this machine.
Mm-hmm.
However, this picture has been confused over the years because of another character who comes involved. And many of our listeners will be shouting, why haven't you mentioned this man yet? This is, of course, Tommy Flowers.
Yeah.
And Tommy Flowers is widely associated with the breaking of Tunney and with this machine, which became known as Robinson, and the subsequent Colossus machine, which we'll get to. The reason Flowers is involved is because he too had been working on the four-rotor bomb projects earlier on, and so he'd had dealings with Bletchley Park. Unfortunately, the bits of the bomb project he'd worked on hadn't worked very well, and he'd had a bit of a falling out with Gordon Welshman in particular, but Flowers had done some work with Turing. And so Turing goes to Max Newman and says, you want to talk to this guy, Flowers. Tommy Flowers is working for the post office. So he's with Frank Morrell and the other people at Dollis Hill. And Turing says, you should talk to Flowers about all this because he's a good guy. He's a good engineer. So Newman took his ideas to Tommy Flowers and said, well, you know, this is what we're doing. We're going to build this machine. Flowers, as many people will know, was a pioneer of the use of electronic valves, not just at Bletchley Park, but in all sorts of systems. He was principally interested in telephone exchanges and turning telephone exchanges from a mechanical device that uses uniselectors, sort of little arms that swing around and magnets and things, to relying on electronic processes using valves. And that was really Flowers' thing. If he could build it out of valves, he was a happy man. That was, you know, where he thought the future lay.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, he was right. The future does lie in electronic processing. It doesn't lie in doing it with valves. It relies on transistors and other better technology. But valves was the technology that ran at the time. So Newman goes off and says to Flowers, how should we do this? Flowers' answer is, you don't need the tapes. You can do all of this with valves. And theoretically, he was correct. You could, in principle, build a machine that did it all with valves. But you would need an enormous number of valves, which were in very short supply. There was a war on. And also, the design of the machine would have had to be extremely intricate and would have taken a very long time to create. And Newman says to him, no, we can't go with the valves. We need to go with the tapes because it's a simpler technology. It may not be quite as brilliant in solving the problem, but it'll be good enough. And Flowers agrees. And the decision is made that, and I quote, they are putting the simple machine with tapes first. Flowers says, OK, I'll forget about valves for a moment. We'll build the tape machine. And Another source we have for this story, which is, again, very recently released, only became available last year, is the so-called war diary from the Dollis Hill GPO research station. This was written by the head of the research station, who was a chap called Gordon Radley, a very interesting man in many ways. He wrote this diary, and all of the projects that Dollis Hill worked on for Bletchley Park appear in that diary, and each job at Dollis Hill is given a different reference number. So you can follow all of the different projects that Dollis Hill was working on for Bletchley by their reference number through the diary. And you just need to, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there about the GPO doing things for other people, sweeping embassies for bugs and building other contraptions for other agencies. But you can find the job numbers and you can follow all of the bomb work, all of the Robinson work, all of the Colossus work in date order.
From the perspective of the GPO as well, rather than...
Yes, from the perspective of Gordon Radley and the GPO. Brilliant. So he's writing about what his team are being asked to do and how they're going about doing it. Hmm. And there's a very interesting piece from June 1943 where Gordon Radley in the Dollis Hill War Diary talks about the two-tape machine that Newman is asking for.
Dollis Hill War Diary, 3rd of June, 1943. In February last, Major General Sir Hastings Ismay wrote to Sir Stanley Angwin regarding a new and urgent problem for the solution of which he said there was the greatest need of haste. Mathematical analysis of the principles involved has indicated that the possible initial settings to be investigated can be reduced to a manageable number by the comparison of a message tape with a key tape. In principle, the coincidences between message and key tapes must be counted with the two tapes occupying all possible positions relative to one another. The development of a machine for doing this rapidly was the problem which Sir Hastings Ismay had in mind. A prototype machine, operating on punched tape, scanned by means of photoelectric cells, has been constructed at Dollis Hill. When running at full speed, each scanning head on the equipment will look at 2,000 characters per second, so that what with manual examination would have been a laborious task of weeks is reduced to a matter of a few hours.
This is Robinson, and the first machine arrives in June of 1943. So the first two-tape machine is delivered. Again, this is described in the Dollis Hill Diary.
Dollis Hill War Diary, 18th of June, 1943. The prototype machine was transported to Bletchley Park on Whit Monday, June the 14th. It was associated with the Wynne Williams high-speed counting rack and tried out on prepared tapes of known counts. After the usual minor teething troubles had been overcome, it was turned over to the operational staff for their use a few days later.
When this machine's delivered, obviously it takes a bit of fettling, but it does work. And almost immediately, Travis is very excited that he asks actually for 24 to be built, which is a pretty crazy number.
And you need a lot of space for that, I'd imagine.
You need a lot of space,
these things
yes.
are not small.
So this machine arrives, it's put in Hut 11. I doubt you'd have fitted more than one or two of them into Hut 11 because Hut 11 is a pretty small and dingy place. They would move to larger facilities later. The first Robinson turns up. And it's installed in Hut 11 with Newman and Jack Good and Donald Mickey. They also get two engineers to help them. And the machine is operated by 16 wrens. This sort of unwritten principle at Bletchley Park that crypto machines are run by wrens.
Yes, the Women's Royal Naval Service push the buttons and tweak the things.
And it starts looking for these statistical variations in the number of holes. And it starts setting the wheels of Tunny. So it's breaking the messages, basically, which is what everyone hoped it would do. And the general report on Tunny, that immediate post-war report I was describing, talks about it. It says, Heath Robinson amply satisfied the demands for flexibility, and there can be little doubt that the opportunities it gave for trying new techniques at this crucial stage played a decisive part in the later successes of Colossus.
So Heath Robinson, what's Heath Robinson?
Heath Robinson was a wartime cartoonist and post-war cartoonist. And he's famous for drawing diagrams of unnecessarily complicated machines. You know, he might draw a cartoon of a machine for cracking a boiled egg that has 15 people pulling levers and lots of pulleys and belts and things. And it was, they were cartoons parodying industrial systems. Mm-hmm. For our American listeners, there's an equivalent American cartoonist, Rube Goldberg, who draws similar sort of fantastical machines. Robinson gets referred to as Robinson and Heath Robinson. And it's not immediately clear from the available literature why it was called Robinson in the first place and where the Heath Robinson bit comes from. You can see the Wrens looking at this thing with all these tapes and wheels and flashing lights and valves and things and going, that's a Heath Robinson device. It's kind of passed down to the language, but certainly when I was young, you would refer to things as a bit Heath Robinson, meaning they looked like they were extremely complicated and liable to fall apart.
You suspect Robinson might just be a shortening of Heath Robinson then? And
it might be, or they might have called it Robinson for some other reason and then the Heath got tacked on. It's one of these ones that we're not entirely sure where the name comes from.
Somewhere there's an engineer Robinson that's been horribly forgotten, isn't there?
Maybe. But anyway, the fact is the machine was known as Robinson or Heath Robinson. And from the summer of 1943, this machine is cranking away, solving tiny messages, and the GPO and TRE set about building more Robinsons.
Some of Travis's 24 units.
Hopefully some of Travis's 24 units, yes. They were pretty urgent. I mean, the request went from the Foreign Office. It is hoped that the first six equipments will be made available to Bletchley Park within 12 weeks.
Blimey, that's fast.
That is fast. It wasn't achieved. But I think in total, Bletchley Park ends up with about four Robinsons. But they do carry on building them through the war because they found that they had all sorts of applications that they hadn't realised when they designed the first one. They produce subsequent models. There's a Super Robinson, which is more capable than the original machine.
Was Robinson the direct parent, I suppose you could say, of the Colossus machine? And if it was, why do we always say it's Colossus that was used to break the Wrens?
That's a very good question. In the answer to the first part, yes, Robinson uses the same methodology, Tutt's deltering method, to look for fitting Lorentz keys onto messages. Colossus does exactly the same thing, but it has become more famous. And in many ways, it's become more famous because Tommy Flowers lived to talk about it a great deal. And Tommy Flowers was more proud of his work on Colossus than his work on Robinson, and so made a lot more of his work on Colossus. And so that story tends to kind of dominate the narrative. And one of the features of that is that when Flowers is telling the story, he tends to tell it from his own point of view. And this is why I wanted to talk about Newman, because even though the section is called the Newmanry, the man Newman seems to get somehow sort of sidelined. We're not completely written out of the story. I mean, all the good books talk about him, but he's not anything like as well-known a figure. And in many ways, he should be, because he's the boss man. He's the ultimate kind of organizer of the whole thing. And it's an interesting contrast to the bombs in some ways, because everyone talks about Turing and Welshman and the bomb machines.
But they were kind of the brains behind.
And they were the theoretical brains.
Yeah.
The actual machines were designed and built by Doc Keane at BTM. And no one's heard of Doc Keane.
But except for regular listeners.
Except for regular listeners and Bletchley Park enthusiasts. But in terms of the public narrative of Bletchley, Doc Keane doesn't feature. With Robinson Colossus, you have kind of the opposite point, that the engineer who put the components together to make the physical manifestation of the theory is the famous one in the sense of Tommy Flowers. Mm-hmm. And the people who had the idea, Bill Tutt, Max Newman, Mickey and Good, tend to be sort of sidelined. So it's kind of the opposite way around. And in both cases, you need both. There are theorists who come up with the concepts, and then there are very clever engineers who make those concepts physical. And you can't do it without both in both cases. It's just unfortunate, perhaps, that the two stories have been told from only one point of view, albeit the opposite points of view, if you like. And we'll come on to Flowers' involvement a little bit more with Colossus, because he says some other things about Colossus which tend to minimise Newman's part in the story. So during the summer of 1943, there was a Robinson and then subsequently more than one Robinson clanking away working. But they are a stopgap solution and they have various problems. One of the problems is that the tapes have to turn very, very quickly. They're paper, they tear, and suddenly from a whirring machine, you've got a room full of meters and meters of tape as it all flies off the spool and goes everywhere. Mm-hmm. There was also problems with the counting, because for the system to work properly, the little photoelectric cell that spots whether there's a hole or not in the tape has to work very, very precisely. And that precision is really hard to achieve, especially with two tapes side by side. Obviously, they both have to move at exactly the same speed and they have to be read at exactly the same time and all the rest of it. So it's very, very tricky to do. And so Newman was talking throughout to Flowers and to Morell and indeed Radley, who's the head of the whole GPO part of the story. And they go, well, we need a better machine. And so Newman, in the latter part of the summer of 1943, Newman goes back to Flowers and says, can you do us a better electronic counter? Can the GPO take over the part of the job that was previously been done by TRE and do this very precise counting part of the job more effectively and ideally faster? Because 2,000 characters a second sounds very quick, but actually it's not quick enough for what they need. Flowers' answer is, of course, yes, I can. But he once again goes back, I can do it with all with valves. And he, for a second time, proposes his completely valve-based machine. And again, Newman says no. Partly this is for the same reasons as the first time, that it would have been very expensive in valves. It would have had a very long development time. But there's a more practical reason, which he also articulated, which is the fundamental difference between Colossus and Robinson is Robinson has a tape for the enciphered message and a tape for the key that represents the wheels in the Rhodes machine. Flowers says, let's replace both of those tapes with sets of valves that have been plugged up with the pattern that's on the tapes.
Right. This feels like this would use a lot of valves, though.
It would use a tremendous number of valves. But the other problem is, if you imagine you've got a 4,000-character long message, mm-hmm. or even longer, because the longer the message, the better the statistical thing works, you know, because your statistical difference is so small that you need a lot of letters for it to work. If for every message you had to plug up each of those characters on the back of the machine by putting in jacks or fitting, Colossus worked with these little sort of U clamps that made the electronic connections. Newman theorized that the wheels are reset every day, but for the whole of the day, the wheels stay the same. So you could do one set of plugging for the wheels, which you could do with valves and these plugs. But to run multiple messages against that set of wheels, it's much quicker to have all the messages on tapes and just run them through one after another. Because if you had to replug the valves that represented the message tape
for every single message,
yeah. It would be unutterably tedious. Mm-hmm. When you switch the machine on, it would be quicker.
It would be defeating the object, though, wouldn't it?
But
the efficiency that you gain.
Plugging it up would take so long. Whereas as it stands, the deltering is a process where you add some of the characters together, which we won't get into. But basically, the message tapes are arriving at the Newmanry already on paper tape because that's how they've been processed through the collection from Knockholt and everything else. So if they're already arriving on paper tape, just feeding the paper tape into the machine is far more efficient than trying to get a Wren to plug up every single character on that tape.
Yeah. And also avoids potential human error as well.
Yes. Any error in the tapes destroys the statistical value of the exercise and makes the breaking redundant. So a big part of the whole Lorentz breaking process is checking and double checking the accuracy of the tapes. They do everything two or three times just to avoid any errors creeping in. Mm-hmm. So if you had humans plugging it up on the back, there's another area for error. So Flowers is once again persuaded that he shouldn't go with the fully valve-based idea. Unfortunately, this is where Flowers' previous history comes back to haunt him, because although Newman thinks the Colossus idea, the one set of valves and one tape machine, is the way to go, his senior management at Bletchley are not convinced. It's not clear who isn't convinced, but given the previous relationship between Gordon Welshman, who is head of mechanisation at Bletchley Park, and for Tommy Flowers, I smell the hand of Welshman in here. They go, no, Robinson works. Just refine Robinson. Don't start a new device. We haven't got time. It's too complicated. Just go with what we know. Make Robinson better. They're a bit stuck at that point, but Newman isn't discouraged, and he goes to Gordon Radley at the GPO and Sir Stanley Angwin, who's also the chief engineer at the GPO. Gordon Radley's head of Dollis Hill, and says, well, we can carry on trying to refine Robinson, but can you get Flowers to work on Colossus as well? And Gordon Radley goes, yeah, that should work. And so another quite famous man called Sidney Broadhurst, who's another engineer at Dollis Hill, he and Flowers and a team of engineers are given a budget to go off and start building Colossus in parallel with the work that's being done to improve Robinson. And Tommy Flowers has told this story many times, both in writing and in recorded interviews. And sometimes he will exaggerate the sort of the clandestineness of this, if you like. Sometimes his versions suggest that he kind of went off unauthorized and spent his own pocket money and built Colossus while no one was looking. Mm-hmm. Actually, the process is sanctioned from the top, from Gordon Radley. It's in the Dollis Hill War Diary. You know, it's clearly a legit activity. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the only person who isn't party to it happening is Gordon Welshman. And it's fairly clear that Newman was in the know as well. So it's not as kind of a wildcat as Flowers sometimes has suggested. But nonetheless, he goes away and he develops the valve side of the machine, the way of representing the wheels with valves, which is extraordinarily clever. And he deserves a huge amount of credit for that. Mm-hmm. Some of this is actually described in the Dollis Hill War Diary, where it talks about the difference between having one tape and having two tapes.
Dollis Hill War Diary, 2nd of October, 1943. It will be recollected that, in the machines now being constructed for this purpose, two paper tapes, one punched in accordance with the intercepted message, and the other determined by the pattern of the cipher system, are passed through machines side by side and scanned photoelectrically. Coincidence is accounted with the two tapes in various relative positions. With this method, Robinson, the speed of working is limited by the difficulties of running two tapes synchronously at speeds exceeding 16 feet or 2,000 characters per second. With Flowers' development, the second tape is dispensed with, and the pattern generated by electronic commutators, which are kept in synchronism by pulses from a photocell, illuminated through the sprocket holes in the message tape.
So, in many ways, although Flowers is rightly credited with the valve-based design of that half of Colossus, the fact that he did it that way is because Newman told him to. Had Flowers had his own complete free rein, he would still have been working in 1946 on a completely valve-based machine that wouldn't have been finished yet. So the story isn't quite as it's sometimes told. However, Flowers is able to come up with the new machine, and the post office deliver a Colossus to Bletchley Park in January 1944. They then go on to build another 9, so 10 are built by the end of the war. And progressively, as these come into service, they take over more and more of the work of breaking Lorentz messages. However, that doesn't mean the Robinsons are just scrapped. They do find that there are certain types of jobs that work on a Robinson better than they work on a Colossus, because both machines are still being revised and tinkered with. And once they've got the machines, they sort of look at them and go, oh, there's a process we could do on there that we hadn't thought of before, but now we thought of it, it would probably work. So there's a sort of evolving process, and both machines continue to be used. But the bulk of the traffic from that point on is broken on the Colossus machines. And, you know, the rest is history. We know that Colossus went on to be extremely successful, and a huge amount of Lorentz traffic was broken. However, if you look in the history of the fish section, which is actually the history of the testery, testery was ultimately responsible for issuing the finished messages, if you like, because Colossus only does one set of wheels, the Kai wheels, as they're called, the two sets of wheels in the Lorentz machines, Kai wheels and side wheels. Colossus only does Kai wheels. So the messages would go back to the testery for a hand process to remove the influence of the side wheels.
De-sighing, deep sighing.
Deep sighing, as they call it, yes.
Deep sighing, yeah.
Another Bletchley Park pun. And so the testery has the figures for how much decrypted material was ultimately produced. And this is a figure that we've quoted in a number of places, including in the D-Day film. 63 million characters of Lorentz traffic were broken by 1945, which is, as I worked it out, 30 Bibles worth of text. So it's a big wallop of stuff. But it's actually only something like 2% of the intercepted traffic. So it's a very small proportion of what is actually picked up. Because you have a problem that only certain messages, they have to be the right length, they have to have various other characteristics that make them amenable to the Colossus method. And so a lot of the traffic they get, they just chuck it away straight away because they go, no, we'll never break that one because it's not long enough or it doesn't have the right characteristics. So they only ever break about 2% of what they intercept. And if you look at that 63 million characters, 23% of that, so nearly a quarter, is broken prior to January 1944. So prior to any Colossus involvement at all. So the story that Lorentz starts being broken when Colossus arrives isn't really true.
No.
More than 25% of the material has been broken before that machine ever appears. And so the sort of hidden character in the story, the chef at Grey Gables in all of this, is Robinson. And behind Robinson is Newman.
Mm-hmm. Who we hope is getting the recognition he deserves from today onwards as well.
Well, we'd hope so, yes. Maybe after 80 years of the Newmanry, we can redress the balance a little bit.
One thing I really wanted to say as well to our listeners, those who want to get a sense of these machines, if you're in the UK, I really recommend visiting our colleagues who are also here on the Bletchley Park campus. The boffins over at the National Museum of Computing have created full-size, recreated working versions of both Robinson and Colossus, haven't they, which are really well worth a look at.
Very much so, yes. And they are in the building that housed some of the Colossus machines during the war. So you get the full experience around there.
Back to Max Newman.
Mm-hmm.
What did he do next?
Well, once the Colossus machines are being delivered fairly regularly and the methodology, if you like, has been mostly developed, they continue to refine their code-breaking methods. They continue to tweak the system. And this is one of the aspects of the story which opens a little bit of a light on what Newman was like as an individual. Because a lot of the veterans who've talked about the Newmanry, and when the Newman is described in the literature, it comes across as a very egalitarian place. Newman was very keen to hear ideas and suggestions from his staff. and they would have what Newman called tea parties, where people would get together, and they more or less had a suggestions book, where if you were operating the machine and you thought something could be done in a slightly different way, you would write it in this book. And every couple of weeks, they'd all have a sit down and they'd go, is that a good idea? Could we use that? You know. And this isn't just Mickey and Good and the engineers. This goes right down to the Wrens as well. The Wrens, who are actually at the coalface operating the machines, are often the ones who know best how the machines work or don't work. So feedback from them is also taken on board. On the one hand, you see Newman as a person who is very accepting of ideas and, you know, intellectually curious and prepared to discuss. But there's a balance between that, and at the same time, he was quite a reserved, quite serious person. And while he's prepared to be egalitarian in terms of discussing improvements to code breaking, he liked things to be quite serious. I mean, there's paperwork in the archives from an episode towards the end of the war at Christmas when some of the BT engineers who were maintaining the Colossus machines hung a piece of mistletoe from their door and were ambushing Wrens in the corridor. Not something we'd necessarily approve of in the workplace these days, but it caused a certain amount of squealing and giggling in the corridor. And Max Newman apparently came flying out of his office in a towering rage. And he actually wrote to the manager of GPO engineers and had statements taken from people as to who had exactly had done what and why this incident had occurred.
Was it just it was inappropriate, or was it just an outbreak of morale? Or
I think it was, you could suggest nowadays that he was taking a view against, you know, harassment. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was. I think he was taking a position against frivolity and triviality.
Mm-hmm.
I think he considered the workplace to be much more serious than that. Mm. And while he was prepared to be very collegiate and conversational, it was all done on a very serious level. So people mucking about, I think, is how he would have seen it.
Yeah.
And I also think because in sort of 44, 45, his job has moved on from a very creative one of developing these machines, coming up with brand new ideas, solving problems, to one where his job is administrative.
Mm.
You know, he's doing HR. He's got, by the end of the war, he's got 200 staff.
Management role, then.
He's doing management. He's writing memos. He's getting things fixed. And I don't think that's what he joined for.
You don't think it suited him?
I don't think it suited him. It wasn't his game. He was much more of a creative, thinking, academic, mathematical person. And, you know, organising, you know, supplies of spare parts and heating oil and things, I don't think was his cup of tea. And that may have made him grumpy, to be honest. But it is clear that he was very, very fond of his staff. Again, William Newman's description describes how the family had moved back to their home in Cambridge, but it was too far for Newman to get to Bletchley Park every day. So he moved into the Duncombe Arms in Brickhill, which is rather notorious because Frank Birch lived in the Duncombe Arms, and it was referred to several times as the Drunken Arms. It had a number of Cambridge academics living in it, and they lived the sort of the life of a fairly disreputable Cambridge college in that pub. Newman lived in there with them, and he would go home for his day off every week and see his wife and family. And William Newman describes his sort of panic in the mornings where he'd be ready to get the train, and he'd suddenly go, oh, my Wrens, and he'd start running around looking for cake.
Oh.
Because he liked to go back to work with treats for his staff, which shows him as a sort of much more thoughtful sort of human guy in a way. He comes across as somebody who is kind of quiet and serious and relaxes by playing the piano at a very high level, but isn't much for malarkey.
Yeah. Also, though, quite different from the impression that we might have got earlier of an intellectual who felt that he wouldn't be sort of mentally stimulated for longer than a year, so has left the option of being able to leave, which it seems he did not after a year.
There is another anecdote about him. Catherine Corky, who worked in the Newmanry, tells a story of him standing on Bletchley Station, rather mysteriously holding a dead hare, which he's presumably going to have for his tea. And she says, are you all right, Professor Newman? And he goes, well, no, I've lost my train ticket. And Catherine goes, well, it shouldn't be a problem. The man on the station here knows you. He knows you work at Bletchley. It won't be a problem. He'll sort you out. And Newman replies, that's not the problem. The problem is I can't remember whether I was going to Oxford or Cambridge. I mean, I don't know how much truth there is, but it describes a man who is kind of living in his head to a certain extent.
Still clutching the dead hair as
Still clutching the dead hair, yes. Equally, he has a tankard because at the end of the war, the staff of the Newmanry clubbed together and bought him a silver tankard to MHAN, which are his initials, to MHAN from the Newmanry, 1942 to 1945. So they clearly liked their boss enough to buy him a leaving present.
Yeah.
So nice but serious, I think, is the way to look at it.
Yeah. And was he head of the Newmanry at Bletchley Park right through to the very end of the war?
He is head to the end of the European War, but, and this is quite notable, you say he stuck around.
Mm.
You know, he said he could leave after a year. There's a letter on file at St. John's College from 1st of June 1945 from Miss Moore, who's a bit of a legend at the Foreign Office, who was the personnel recruiter at the Foreign Office, accepting his resignation. So if you consider the war has ended on May the 8th, before the end of the month, he's got his resignation letter in and he's off. I mean, never mind, because Robinson was latterly adapted to work on Japanese systems.
So it didn't slow down so the
numinary didn't cease to function.
Yeah.
And Colossus carried on being used by GCHQ. Two of the machines were taken to GCHQ and used in the 1950s. So there was still work to do. But as soon as the European war finished, Newman basically went, I quit, I'm off. And he left. So he stuck around, but he didn't stick around any longer than he needed to. I suspect by the time you get to May 1945, the fun has gone out of the job to a certain extent. He's done the major part of the creative side of the role, and he's left running a department, essentially, which was never his cup of tea, I don't think.
And now, oh, what wonderful luck. At this moment, how wonderful, Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony. Now Mr. Churchill stands on the balcony of the Ministry of Health. He's wearing his boiler suit, the famous boiler suit that he's made so wonderful. And he had the audacity, shall I say, to put on his head his famous black hat. Nobody can say that it goes with a boiler suit, but you heard what a cheer it raised from the crowd. He stands now in the floodlights, and he's giving the victory sign for all his might from the flooded balcony.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is every man. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Everyone, man or woman, has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all.
So he wasn't at Bletchley Park. What did he do?
Well, this is where Patrick Blackett reappears, his old friend. Patrick Blackett had actually left Cambridge in 1937 and gone to head the physics department at the University of Manchester. When Blackett went to the Admiralty, he went from Manchester rather than from Cambridge. And in 1945, he suggested that Newman come to Manchester. And there was a chair of mathematics available at Manchester, the Fielden chair. And so in September of 1945, Max Newman heads up to Manchester to become head of their maths department. And almost immediately, he is thinking about computing. His immediate task when he gets to Manchester is to build a computer, for want of a better term. I mean, that's oversimplifying it slightly because no one knows what a computer is yet. But he sets about this and he establishes what becomes the Royal Society Computing Machine Laboratory. And it's called that because he actually applies to the Royal Society, of which he is a fellow, for some funding to build a computer. They fund the project and he sets this thing up. The purpose of what he's doing is very, very clear because his not quite namesake, John von Neumann, who is at Princeton, who is also a very famous figure in the history of information science and computing. He wrote to John von Neumann in February 1946 saying, I am hoping to embark on a computing machine section here, meaning Manchester. Having got very interested in electronic devices of this kind during the last 2 or 3 years.
Of the war.
Which is a lovely allusion to Robinson and Colossus. I am, of course, in close touch with Turing. So von Neumann would have been aware of uncomputable numbers and Turing and Newman's interest in computing or computing machines and the theory of computing back in 1936-37 and during both of them's first visit to Princeton in 1937.
They'd all have been colleagues at
They'd all have been known each other very well.
Yeah.
And so clearly Newman is keen to pick up the reins of those projects as quickly as he can. And by coincidence, in the autumn of 1946, Princeton University is having its bicentennial, so 200 years of Princeton. And so there's going to be various celebrations. And Newman is invited to go for the celebrations. And he takes this opportunity to meet von Neumann and the other, and no doubt Alonzo Church and all the other people who were thinking the same thoughts about computing in the US. Because it's a separate story, but von Neumann has been working on American early computing devices at the same time. And actually, for many years, until the story of Colossus came out, the story of computing led back to von Neumann's machine immediately post-war, because the Americans made it public very, very soon after the war, whereas Colossus and Robinson stayed secret. So he went to Princeton and discussed all this with von Neumann, goes back to Manchester, and then he starts shopping around for people to work in his team. He goes back to Malvern, to the telecommunications research establishment, which is where they'd gone originally for the switching for Robinson. So they're still in touch with people there. And there's two chaps called Frederick Calland Williams and Thomas Kilburn who moved to Manchester. And they work on what will become the Manchester Baby, which is one of the first British computers. They're not the only people he calls on, because, of course, Turing remains part of the picture. And in 1945, Turing had found his way to NPL, National Physical Laboratory, which was a government-funded research establishment that was working on computers as well. Turing went there in 1946. He didn't do very well. The NPL project wasn't progressing anything like as rapidly as the Manchester project. And so in 1948, Newman got in touch with Turing and said, come to Manchester. He poached him from NPL. And he joins Kilburn and Williams, who are already there, been working on Baby. And they go on to produce the Manchester Mark I, which is, again, one of the founding famous computers in the UK. That, of course, leads on to the Ferranti Mark I, which was the first commercially purchasable computer in the UK. And Turing worked on that as well. There's a rather nice photograph of Turing with the Manchester Mark, yes, with the Ferranti Mark I.
I saw that this week. It's wonderful. Have a Google, the 1950s. Listeners. We recommend.
And so Turing and Newman are there right at the birthplace of British computing. And you can follow that thread right through to, you know, the computers we use nowadays. But what I think you see at Manchester is similar to what you saw in the spring of 1943 in the Newmanry, that Newman is going, right, who do I need to do this? Who are the experts I need? And he's picking people, be it from TRE, be it from Dollis Hill, you know, tracking down Turing at NPL. He's a good builder of a crew, and then getting those people to pursue the task. And similarly to when he's in the Newmanry, he doesn't stay in computers in Manchester. He actually goes back to topology.
Can take the man out of topology, but you can't.
I think also because he is ultimately a theoretical mathematician and a logician, and his real love is the, as his course was called, the foundations of mathematics. The rest is engineering, and he's not an engineer. That's not his, I don't think that's his natural thing. And you can say similar things about Turing. I don't personally believe Turing was an engineer. He was a theoretician and a logician. And I think that's why Turing and Newman get on, is because they both exist in that sort of theoretical ether rather than in the, you know, bolting things together. But nonetheless, their ideas get bolted together by other people to produce, you know, the revolution that we're all familiar with.
So he continued as an academic in this sort of foundations of mathematics, topology field for the rest of his life?
He carried on at Manchester until 1964, so best part of another 20 years. The biography by William Newman would suggest that he never really settled in Manchester. He was a Cambridge guy. He liked Cambridge, and they never fully got rid of their home in Cambridge. And there were long periods when Lynn, his wife, would live in Cambridge and he would live in Manchester, which probably didn't help. But he never liked Manchester, I don't think. And so when he retired, he went back to Cambridge. And you remember his friend Lionel Penrose that he went to Vienna with back in the 1920s? Mm. Newman's wife, Lynn, died in 1973. And then Lionel Penrose himself died, and his widow Margaret and Max got together, and Max Newman married Margaret Penrose subsequently. Max lived married to Margaret for another 10 years and died in 1984.
The secret of Bletchley Park and GCNCS was revealed in the 1970s, but was Newman ever sort of publicly acknowledged and rewarded for the work that he did?
It's one of those weird ones. He was one of the people who, after the war, was offered an honour, like a New Year's honour type thing. He was offered an OBE in 1947, but he turned it down. Again, in the St. John's College archive, there's a letter from Newman, or there's the reply from Downing Street saying, terribly sorry to hear you don't want this, but if that's your wish, we won't give it to you. The suggestion is that he felt that other people deserved more credit than he did, and Turing in particular, he felt, although Turing had been given an OBE in 1946, but Newman didn't think that was enough. He think Turing should have been given better credit for his work. The problem with, of course, what they both did was still secret.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you can be given an honour secretly and you can go and see the king and get your medal, but you never tell anybody why you got it, which must have all been very weird anyway. But the other aspect of Newman is you get the impression he was quite a private person and he didn't like sort of a lot of fuss about these things. And he would probably have turned down a decoration anyway because he just didn't feel it was, you know, the thing. There's also the point that when the story of Bletchley Park becomes public in 1974, it's only the Enigma story that becomes public. The story of Colossus and the breaking of Lorenz and Robinson remained secret for many years after. As I say, the general report on Tunney was only declassified in 2004, by which time Newman had been long dead. So he would never have had an opportunity. He could have talked about being at Bletchley Park, but he couldn't have talked about what he actually did at Bletchley Park. So it would have put him in a very awkward position. And what's interesting, when I was doing my D-Day work, one of the features of that is a lot of the literature prior to 2000 doesn't acknowledge the role of Lorenz-based intelligence alongside Enigma intelligence, because when a lot of those books were written, that side of the story was still secret. So he never had an opportunity to talk publicly about his wartime work.
Before the war and afterwards are two different stories that would have come out at different times. And of course, none of the Bletchley people could talk about what they did. And so I think he would have gone through pretty much what all the Bletchley people went through, proud of what he did, but unable to share it. All I knew, for example, as a child, was that my father went off to Bletchley every week, and I just took that for granted. I didn't know what Bletchley was. There were quite a lot of people who really achieved no public recognition. But in some ways, I think they were comfortable with that because they were so accustomed to saying nothing about it that it was very hard to start to reveal secrets and, you know, probably a little bit of guilt hanging there. I got to know a Wren who worked there who couldn't tell her sister anything. And when it was lifted, she still found it difficult to tell her. And when I met them together once, I noticed that whenever she mentioned something, her sister would say, "You didn't tell me that." And it had actually broken down, to some extent, the relationship, a very close relationship between these two sisters, that they hadn't been able to really share things in post-war years.
People find it hard, don't they, to understand in today's information age, and they find it difficult to grasp the natural secrecy.
Yes, I discovered that when I was quite young because of the silver tankard. The silver tankard arrived after war was over. Those words on it, you know, to MHAN from the Newmanry. I'd never heard of the Newmanry. And so, of course, I asked, "Well, what's the Newmanry?" And my mother eventually took me aside and said, "It was to do with codes, but you must never tell anybody." And so, of course, I didn't.
What are your memories of when it started to come out in the 70s, William?
I knew a little bit, as I've said, about it. And I was rather pleased because it was just nice to know that he did something worthwhile.
Did he ever talk about it, or did he sort of remain fairly tight-lipped?
I would say fairly tight-lipped, but he could think of a few things that he felt he knew were innocuous, like the machine that they had at Bletchley that they used to show to important visitors, which had lots of flashing lights on it, and they would always take them to see this machine because it was, you know, sort of fancy. But in fact, I don't think it was a very important machine. I think it may have been the machine that simulated the Tunney. And that sort of thing he could tell us about.
What about his post-war work? Has he been recognised for that?
In the right circles, he is justly famous, I think. And if you read work on the history of computing and on AI and these things, his name is right there because he was the head of the department in Manchester where the first computers were built. But he's not a household name in the way, for example, Turing is.
Perhaps he might have been comfortable with that, though.
I think he might have been. I mean, I'm not sure what Turing would have made of his appearing on a £50 note. I think he would have found that quite odd. But Newman deserves to be recognised both for his foundational work on computing, and that goes right back to his support for Turing in 1936, 1937, and his work at Princeton with von Neumann and Alonzo Church. And he's right there in the mix of all of this early computing. Also, his contribution to the war, in the sense of running the Newmanry, is fundamental as well. But there, the spotlight has fallen on Tommy Flowers, because Flowers lived into the period when the story was declassified and was able to talk about it personally in a way that Newman never was. So the spotlight has not shone on Newman there. And so I think he deserves to be a lot better known than he actually is. I was actually looking into this because I thought he must be memorialised somewhere. There must be something, you know, with his name on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was slightly saddened that Manchester University used to have a Newman building, but they knocked it down because they've built a swanky new maths department. which of course is the Alan Turing building. And within it is a Max Newman lecture theatre.
Right.
A little bit of me feels that that ought to be the other way around.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.